Hello, everybody, and welcome to the first episode extra for episode 79, The Triumph of the Sans-Culottes. In this episode extra, I want to explore some of the debates surrounding how we should interpret the events of 4 and 5 September. For example, was this a case where the Sans-Culottes imposed their will on both the commune and the convention, or were the authorities more agreeable to reforms than they first might appear? Furthermore, when discussing the Hébertists in particular, was this a case where the ultra-radicals were leading an insurrection, which they had largely manufactured, or was this a popular uprising which they followed rather than led? So, let's start off by exploring the first point. Should these events be viewed as the Sans-Culottes imposing their demands on a reluctant convention? Most historians say yes. Historian Albert Sabul, for example, he describes these events as a Sans-Culottes shove. Essentially, he's portraying the people as pushing a hostile convention into action that they didn't really want to take. Now, Sabul's a Marxist historian, so he tends to analyze the revolution through a prism of class conflict. As such, he highlights things like the fact that the Jacobin deputies, aka the bourgeois deputies, were only willing to accept economic controls on prices and the distribution of goods when it was forced upon them. And historian Eric Hazen, writing in the 21st century, but with similar perspectives to Sabul, some people might describe him as a neo-Marxist, he tends to agree. Hazen states plainly that the Commune, the Jacobins, the Convention, and the Committee of Public Safety had all been swept along by the irresistible Parisian movement. So here we see two depictions of these events where the authorities were compelled to implement policies essentially against their will. But before we get into the role of the Hébertist commune in all of this, it is worth noting that some historians take a very different view. Historian Simon Sharma, for example, he's a British revisionist historian and he offers a unique perspective on these events. While scholars like Sabul and Hazen note the economic nature of many of the Sans-Culottes demands, Sharma de-emphasizes this component, and instead he asserts that other issues dominated the agenda, and that as a result of that, the convention was more willing to pass terror-related measures than it might appear.
When the next revolutionary day duly occurred on September 4 and 5, the orators of the Commune, who demanded economic protection and aggressive punishment of malefactors, found themselves knocking on an open door. The day should not be read as an imposition of Sans-Culottism on a reluctant and frightened convention. In fact, the occasion was dominated not by the economic crisis, but by the shattering news that Toulon had opened its harbour and city to the British fleet, commanded by Admiral Hood. This created the atmosphere of patriotic emergency in which Danton and Barrère thrived. It was no hard thing, then, to declare that terror will be the order of the day, since the Convention and the Committee of Public Safety had a shrewd idea that they would be its executors.
So, Sharma takes a noticeably different perspective of these events. For Sharma, the Jacobins were eager to decree extreme legislation, given the fact that they would ultimately wield the power granted by repressive decrees. Furthermore, Sharma downplays the importance of the economic crisis in shaping the nature of the people's demands. Now, in this view, Sharma is relatively isolated. For many historians, the economic crisis was a sizable portion of what defined these events. After all, even the purpose of the Revolutionary Army was, in large part, to ensure the regular supply of cheap bread by forcefully requisitioning goods in the countryside. Furthermore, if the Convention was willing to pass these measures, why had it not done so before a crowd had burst into the chamber and demanded immediate action? Yes, news of Toulon's treason provided greater justification for extreme remedies, But the deputies already had sufficient grounds to enact these reforms. I would argue that they lacked sufficient desire, something that was supplied by a hungry and agitated crowd occupying the seats next door to them. For the perspective of a non-Marxist historian writing in the 20th century, I would turn instead to the American scholar Robert Palmer. Palmer, unlike Sharma, specialised in the French Revolution, and he certainly rejects the idea that popular policies were being embraced by a like-minded convention. Instead, Palmer points to the commune, the clubs, and politically astute deputies as the chief drivers of these reforms. Reforms which the convention would rather not have enacted if they had been allowed to deliberate without the threatening presence of the insurrectionists. Palmer writes, "It was clear from the events of the day that the National Convention was not the real government, that its most important committee could not guide its councils in a crisis, that the policies of the Republic were still shaped, as they had long been, by the Jacobin Club, the Commune, and a few members of the Convention who were out of office." So, one debate regarding the 4th and 5th of September relates to the Convention. Was the body forced to embrace price controls and the Revolutionary Army, or was it ready to do so, especially after Toulon's betrayal? I tend to think that the convention was compelled to act against its will, as many of the policies enacted had been opposed or stalled for several months. Remember, the convention had already decreed the Revolutionary Army after the purge of the Girondins, and then did nothing. Likewise, the convention could have decreed price controls at any moment, but only did so after a menacing crowd looked ready to sack Town Hall. But that quote from Robert Palmer offers us a second interesting question. Palmer states that the policies of the Republic were being shaped by the Jacobin Club and the Commune. As such, how should we interpret the role of the Hubertists in this successful insurrection? Prior to the 4th of September, when a crowd first gathered in front of Town Hall, it's clear that the ultra-radicals were agitating for some sort of demonstration. Even before Toulon's treason, Hubert was already marshalling the Jacobins to unite with the sections and the Commune to petition the convention to enact extreme measures. Now, these actions were being taken in late August and were renewed in early September when news of Toulon's betrayal hit the capital. As such, some historians see evidence of a carefully cultivated strategy to unleash the Parisian sans-culottes. For example, historian Albert Maty describes these events as a Hubertist shove, an important distinction from the sans-culottes shove depicted by his fellow Marxist scholar Albert Sabol. While Maty and others see a plan for insurrection, others aren't convinced. In particular, it's not clear that the crowd which assembled on the morning of the 4th was the result of a careful and deliberate strategy to promote insurrection. In previous efforts to force popular demands upon the government, radicals had thoughtfully planned a multi-staged rising. For example, during the purge of the Girondins, central committees were established to coordinate the Commune, the clubs, the sections, and the National Guard. No such organisation was present before the morning of the 4th, which is why some historians question how cultivated this crowd was. Indeed, it might have just been spontaneous. Yes, it was no doubt fostered by the fact that the Hubertists had been calling for collective action in the preceding weeks. But that doesn't mean they had spent the days prior carefully scheduling a crowd to materialise on the morning of the 4th. Indeed, if this crowd was spontaneous, it does explain why the assembled citizens were so hostile to the Hubertist commune officials. Remember, they lampooned Mayor Pache, and it took some clever words from Chumet and Hubert to defuse the agitated crowd. At this point, the Hubertists were by no means in control of events, even if they had secretly assembled the gathering. It wasn't until the next day, the 5th, that the ultra-radicals had managed to gain leadership of the rising and steer it towards their own agenda. It's for this reason that historian Albert Sabul states that the sans-culotte shove was followed rather than guided by the Ebertists. Likewise, Eric Hazen states that both the convention and the commune had been swept along by the irresistible Parisian movement. So, while we can agree that the Ebertists managed to use this rising for their own political benefit, we do not get agreement over how much they instigated these events. Did they encourage a popular demonstration? Yes. But did they carefully assemble the crowd which almost devoured them on the morning of the 4th? Maybe. Alternatively, they might just have used their popularity to hijack a spontaneous gathering of angry, hungry, and fearful people. People who were responding to their earlier calls for action and a revolutionary tradition of collective demonstrations. As such, whether the Ebertists were always leaders of these events, or in fact following the people they claimed to lead, remains a contested debate. If the latter, it wouldn't be the first time where citizens led their champions. As always, thank you for listening to this episode extra on the events of 4 and 5 September, and thank you for your support of the show. If you could recommend the show to at least one person between now and the next episode, that would be absolutely amazing. Thank you for listening, thank you for your support, stay safe, and have a great day.